Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is June 20th, 2003. Today's session is Eudora Welty, Session 5 of Short Stories, Healing Body and Soul, presented by David Wee, WED 2003-05. Let's listen in.
My name is David Wee. I teach literature and writing at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And this week we've been having a session each day on short stories, reading stories that have to do with healing body and soul under the larger summer theme of healing the world. Our story for today is by Eudora Welty, entitled A Worn Path. Now, I need to let you know it's just fine if you haven't read the story already, and some of you may have read it in the past or had a chance to read it this week, but just to help me sense, how many of you have read A Worn Path? Okay, just a few, so we'll listen to parts of it. One of the important things about responding to literature, is, and especially to stories, is to hear them and to get a sense of the voice of the writer and not just know what happened next and what happened next, but actually to hear the way in which the writer tells the story. So we've got several copies of texts here in the room, and if you'd like to pass this one on to somebody. The story is near the back, because most of these are alphabetical, so Eudora Welty is there with a tab near the back, a worn path. This is not the kind of story that would excite the general entertainment public of our time.
So I'm leaving.
you're clearly What happens is this. An old woman takes a long walk into town, goes to the doctor's office, gets some medicine, and leaves. That's the whole plot of this story. But of course, there's much more in the story than that plot would suggest. The woman, whose name is Phoenix Jackson, is a black woman from the Deep South. She is very, very old. We aren't told how old she is in years, but she is a very old woman, has difficulty walking. At one point in the story, she falls into a ditch. She gets knocked over by a dog, falls into a ditch, lands on her back. She can't get up. She's just lying there until someone comes along and helps her out. She can hardly see, does some very courageous things given that fact. And she takes a long journey. And what we discover in the end is that she has been doing this with some regularity. So the story has seemingly very little excitement to hold us. Yet I find this to be one of the most inspiring stories, short stories that I know. And I consider Phoenix Jackson, the woman in this story, to be one of the great literary heroes of our time. And I hope you feel that way by the time we're done with the story. As we've talked about briefly in earlier sessions this week, for many writers of really good stories, the important thing is not what happens physically, not how this party gets from here to there, and what happens, and who dies, and who wins, and all of that. The important thing for really good story writers is what happens internally. What happens emotionally, what happens spiritually, the things that we can't see but often need to infer as we read. And this is surely one of those stories, because this would not make a box office hit movie, just watching this old lady walk into town and get some medicine at the doctor's office and take your first step out the door, and that's the end of the story. But let's hear some of this story. And how many of you have got the text that's open to the page? Okay, we've got about four of you there. Would one of you start, just read the first two paragraphs of the story, in which we get some of the important description of this old black woman, Phoenix Jackson.
It was December, a bright frozen day in the early morning. Far out in the country, there was an old Negro woman with her head tied in a red rag, coming along a path through the pine woods. Her name was Phoenix Jackson. She was very old and small, and she walked slowly in the dark pine shadows, moving a little from side to side in her steps with the balanced heaviness and lightness of a pendulum in a grandfather clock. She carried a thin, small cane made from an umbrella, and with this she kept tapping the frozen earth in front of her. This made a grave and persistent noise in the still air that seemed meditative, like the chirping of a solitary little bird. She wore a dark striped dress reaching down to her shoe tops and an equally long apron of bleached sugar sacks with a full pocket all neat and tidy. But every time she took a step, she might have fallen over her shoelaces, which dragged from her unlaced shoes. She looked straight ahead. Her eyes were blue with age. Her skin had a pattern all its own of numberless branching wrinkles, and as though a whole little tree stood in the middle of her forehead, but a golden color ran underneath, and the two knobs of her cheeks were illuminated by a yellow burning under the dark. Under the red rag, her hair came down on her neck in the frailest of ringlets, still black and with an odor like copper.
Thank you. Okay, you can see her, I trust. Very old, veined, eyes are not perfectly clear, frail. The details surrounding her have to do with the chirping of a bird, and you know, she is very light and a wispy person. Now, for much of the story, we simply read the brief encounters that she has on this trip through the Natchez Trace into town. Some of these encounters are modest and seemingly unimportant. Others, a couple of the encounters that she has with others are worth hearing in full. But listen now to some of the early encounters that she has on this trip. I'd like to have somebody read the next half page or so, beginning with "Now and then there was a quivering in the thicket."
Now and then there was a quivering in the thicket. Old Phoenix said, "Out of my way, all you foxes and owls, beetles, jackrabbits, coons, and wild animals. Keep out from under these feet, little bobwhites. Keep the big wild hogs out of my path. Don't let none of those come running my direction. I got a long way." Under her small black freckled hand, her cane, limber as a buggy whip, would switch at the brush as if to rouse any hiding things. On she went. The woods were deep and still. The sun made the pine needles almost too bright to look at, up where the wind rocked. The cones dropped as light as feathers. Down in the hollow was the mourning dove. It was not too late for him. The path ran up the hill. Seems like there is chains about my feet. Time I get this far, she said in the voice of argument, old people keep to use with themselves. Something always take a hold of me on this hill. Please, I should stay.
Okay, why don't you pause there? Thank you. You can see how difficult this is. You know, when we think of what it's like to hike to Heart Lake or Holden Lake at our relatively young age compared to Phoenix Jackson, and how daunting it is to try to think about making it up those last stretches. Here she is, hardly able to walk, and she comes to the uphill parts and it feels like there are chains on her legs. You know, some of us have felt that, but for her, it must be intensified many times over what it is for those of us who are younger and more able. She's also cautious about other creatures. You know, she has to keep beating the bushes to scare away creatures who might bother her. She's hoping the big wild hogs are going to come out and frighten her, just like we worry about cougars and bears and so forth. She's all alone. It's winter time. And she's making this long trek. And we can already begin to tell how familiar this trek is for her, because she knows all the creatures who are there. She's obviously encountered the wild boars coming out at her once or twice before. So she's attentive to all of that. A couple paragraphs later, we read this. Before she got to the bottom of a hill, a bush caught her dress. Her fingers were busy and intent, but her skirts were full and long, so that before she could pull them free in one place, they were caught in another. It was not possible to allow the dress to tear. She's a lady, and she's going to town. She cannot show up with a torn dress. "I in the thorny bush," she said. "Thorns, you doing your appointed work. Never want to let folks pass, no sir. Old eyes thought you was a pretty little green bush." So even when she's in a rough predicament, she recognizes the natural order of things, the purpose of even plants and animals, and that these thorn bushes are doing their appointed work. And yet she was too, she can't see well enough to tell that these were the thorn bushes. So, finally, trembling all over, she stood free and after a moment dared to stoop for her cane. It's taken her a long time to carefully get her long dress out of the thorns without tearing it. She's had to put her cane down. She's trembling from the effort. You can hardly lean over to pick up her cane. A couple paragraphs later, she says, and we read, "At the foot of this hill was a place where a log was laid across the creek." Would somebody read on from that spot for a few paragraphs?
"Now comes the trial," said Phoenix. "Putting her right foot out, she mounted the log and shut her eyes, lifting her skirt, leveling her cane fiercely before her. Like a festival figure in some parade, she began to march across. Then she opened her eyes and she was safe on the other side. I wasn't as old as I thought," she said. But she sat down to rest. She spread her skirts on the bank around her and folded her hands over her knees. Up above her was a tree in a pearly cloud of mistletoe. She did not dare to close her eyes, and when a little boy brought her a plate with a slice of marble cake on it, she spoke to him. That would be acceptable, she said. But when she went to take it, there was just her own hand in the air. So she left that tree and had to go through a barbed wire fence. There she had to creep and crawl, spreading her knees and stretching her fingers like a baby trying to climb the steps. But she talked loudly to herself. She could not let her dress be torn now, so late in the day, and she could not pay for having her arm or her leg sawed off if she got caught fast where she was."
Okay, thanks. We're learning a little bit more about her. Imagine someone in her condition having to get up on a log over the creek, closing her eyes, and walking across till she's on the other side. This was the trial. So she's facing some real challenges here. Then she has to get through barbed wire fencing. You know, all of us know how difficult that is alone, or even with somebody else holding the wires for us. But again, she mustn't tear her dress. So she's got to get through, and she doesn't want to get caught, because if she got her arm or her leg caught, according to her thinking, she'd have to have her arm cut off to free her from the fence. Her mental faculties are not always with her in quite the way we would expect them to be. Next, she encounters a buzzard in a field, and then she makes her way along a furrow in this field. If you've got the spot here and could begin with, "Glad this not the season for bulls." In that spot.
"Glad this not the season for bulls," she said, looking sideways. "And the good Lord made his snakes to curl up and sleep in the winter. A pleasure I don't see no two-headed snake coming around that tree where it come once. It took a while to get by him back in the summer." She passed through the old cotton and went into a field of dead corn. It whispered and shook and was taller than her head. "Through the maze now," she said, for there was no path. Then there was something tall, black, and skinny there, moving before her. At first, she took it for a man. It could have been a man dancing in the field, but she stood still and listened, and it did not make a sound. It was silent as a ghost. "Ghost," she said sharply, "who you be the ghost of? For I have heard of nearly death close by." But there was no answer, only the ragged dancing in the wind. She shut her eyes, reached out her hand, and touched a sleeve. She found a coat, and inside that, an emptiness, cold as ice. "You scarecrow," she said, her face lighted. "I ought to be shut up for good," she said with laughter. "My senses is gone. I too old. I the oldest people I ever know. Dance, old scarecrow," she said, "while I dancing with you." She kicked her foot over the furrow, and with mouth drawn down, shook her head once or twice in a little strutting way. Some husks blew down and whirled streamers about her skirts.
Okay, thanks. Couple more dangerous things she's been through here before, and she's encountered what she saw as a two-headed snake. You know, we can assume it was just a regular old snake. She knows there are bulls at certain times of year, and she's glad it's not the season for bulls. I once had to enter a field full of bulls when I was courting Karen, and her dad said, "Go out and scare those bulls toward the gate, would you?" I sympathize with the terror that one would feel in her situation.
Did you do it?
I did it. She was worth it. Then she sees a figure that looks like a man, threatening, odd. She asks who it is. "Are you a ghost?" She believes in ghosts, and here appears to be a ghost. She finally reaches out and discovers it's a scarecrow just flapping in the wind. So she realizes it's just a scarecrow dancing, so she dances with it. You know, just does a few little kicks and turns of her head. She knows what the dangers are on this trip. And then she encounters some unexpected things, like a ghost. And we know that when she sat down under the tree, she sees a boy offering her a piece of marble cake. It was just an hallucination, nothing there. So she's losing some of her faculties a bit. But even in spite of this, you know, she's able to dance with the scarecrow. She participates in the joy of life, even on this treacherous journey. Later on, she goes by an old spring that she knows was there when she was born, and it's old as can be. We get several details in the story that let us know how old she is. Then comes the scene where she gets knocked over by the dog, and for about a page, we have an encounter with a man with a gun. Again, She's all alone out here on a cold December day. Would somebody else who's got it now start with the paragraph, a black dog with a lolling tongue came up out of the weeds by the ditch. We all have different page numbers in these books, so.
Black dog with a lolling tongue came up out of the weeds by the ditch. She was meditating and not ready. And when he came at her side, only hit him with a little, she only hit him with a little with her cane. Over she went in the ditch like a little puff of milkweed. Down there, her senses drifted away. A dream visited her, and she reached her hand up, but nothing reached down and gave her hope. So she lay there and presently went to talking. Old woman, she said to herself, that black dog come up out of the weeds to stall you off, and now there he's sitting on his fine tail smiling at you. A white man finally came along and found her, a hunter, a young man with his dog and a chain. Well, Granny, he laughed, what are you doing there? Laying on my back like a June bug waiting to be turned over, mister, she said, reaching up her hand. He lifted her up and gave her a swing in the air and set her down. Anything broken, Granny? No, sir. Them old dead weeds is springing up, said Phoenix when she got her breath. Thank you for your trouble. Where you live, Granny? He asked while the two dogs were growling at each other. Way back yonder, sir, beyond the ridge. You can't even see it from here. Find your way home? No, sir. I go into town. Why, that's too far. That's as far as I walk when I come out myself and I get something for my trouble. He patted the stuffed bag he carried, and there hung down a little closed claw. It was one of the bob whites, with its beak hooked bitterly to show it was dead. Now you go on home, Granny. I'm bound to go to town, mister, said Phoenix. The time come round. He gave another laugh, filling the whole landscape. I know you all colored people wouldn't miss going to town to see Santa Claus. But something held old Phoenix very still. The deep lines in her face went into a fierce and different radiation. Without warning, she had seen with her own eyes a flashing nickel fall out of a man's pocket onto the ground. How old are you, Granny? He was saying. There's no telling, mister, she said, no telling. Then she gave a little cry and clapped her hands and said, get on away from here, dog. Look at that dog. She laughed as it was, as if in admiration. He ain't scared of nobody. He's a big black dog, she whispered, sick of him. Watch me get rid of that cur, said the man. Sick him, Pete, sick him. Phoenix heard the dogs fighting and heard the man running and throwing sticks. She even heard a gunshot, but she was slowly bending forward by that time, further and further forward. The lid stretched down over her eyes as if she were doing this in her sleep. Her chin was lowered almost to her knees. The yellow palm of her hand came out from the fold of her apron. Her fingers slid down and along the ground under the piece of money with the grace and care they would have and lifting an egg from under a sitting hen. Then she slowly straightened up. She stood erect, and the nickel was in her apron pocket. A bird flew by, her lips moved. God watching me the whole time. I've come to steal him.
Okay, let's pause there. Thank you. She's fallen helplessly into the ditch. Young man comes along, discovers how far she is away from home and from town, and realizes this is farther than he, a young hunter, would ever come. And she's already come that far and tells her she should go home, and she says, going to town, the time has come. What attitude does he have toward her at this point? What does he assume about her? He wants to see Santa Claus, okay. Very patronizing toward black people at this point and toward and this very old woman. What we are going to find out is the kind of journey she is on is far more significant than that. But that's his assumption, kind of cultural assumption, that any black person at this time of year in December, traveling this far would be just wanting to see Santa Claus. And then we have this interesting episode where she sees the coin fall out of pocket on the ground. And did you sense that she intentionally suggests that the dog go off chasing the other dog? And she thinks up a little diversion, and while the man and the dog are off chasing the other one, she needs time to bend down and get her hand under that nickel and pull it up and drop it into her apron pocket. And then just at this moment, a bird flies by and she knows God's been watching her. She's come to stealing. You know, she's ashamed of herself here for having done this. But it makes more sense to us later on. I'll read the next little episode here. The man came back and his own dog panted about them. "Well, I scared him off that time," he said, and then he laughed and lifted his gun and pointed it at Phoenix. He's got a rifle. Points it right at her. She stood straight and faced him. "Doesn't the gun scare you?" he said, still pointing it. "No, sir, I've seen plenty go off closer by in my day, and for less than what I done," she said, holding utterly still, less than stealing the nickel. He smiled and shouldered the gun. "Well, Granny," he said, "you must be 100 years old and scared of nothing. I'd give you a dime if I had any money with me." That's why I think he dropped that nickel on purpose. He claims he doesn't have any money. But he didn't want to hand it to her. He wanted her to find it. Instead of doing what Julian's mother did in the story we read a few days ago by Flannery O'Connor, giving a little black child a penny. "But you take my advice and stay home and nothing will happen to you." "I'm bound to go on my way, mister," said Phoenix. She inclined her head in the red rag and then they went off in different directions. So now she's on her own again. Pretty soon she does come to the city, comes into town, there are bright lights, and it is Christmas time. And she has to stop a well-dressed lady who's carrying packages to ask her to tie her shoes. She's been walking along with her shoes untied the whole way. She can't bend over enough to tie her shoes. So she tells this woman, "You can't tie your shoes with a cane." So she's since she's now in the city, she mustn't have untied shoes anymore, just as she was concerned about not having a torn dress. So she gets her shoes tied by a woman who just comes walking by. And then she comes to the big building. She entered a door, and there she saw, I'll start a sentence earlier, moving slowly and from side to side, she went into the big building and into a tower of steps, where she walked up and around until her feet knew to stop. She can't even read the numbers to tell what floor she's on, but she goes around and around and her feet know when to stop. She entered a door, and there she saw nailed up on the wall the document that had been stamped with the gold seal and framed in the gold frame, which matched the dream that was hung up in her head. "Here I be," she said. There was a fixed and ceremonial stiffness over her body. "A charity case, I suppose," said an attendant who sat at the desk before her. She knows she's in the right place because she's so used to making this trip that her feet just know when to stop, what floor, the doctor's office. And she opens the door and there's the doctor's medical certificate on the wall. So she's in the right spot. And the first words we hear from one of the attendants is "a charity case." Again, the sense of it's a black person who looked poor. It must be a charity case. Then there's a fascinating exchange between the physician's assistants and the nurse and Phoenix that tells us some important things about Phoenix and her mission here. Somebody at the spot here, say the paragraph that begins, "Speak up, Grandma," the woman said, "what's your name?"
"Speak up, Grandma," the woman said, "what's your name? We must have your history, you know. Have you been here before? What seems to be the trouble with you?" Old Phoenix only gave a twitch to her face as if a fly were bothering her. "Are you deaf?" cried the attendant. But then the nurse came in. "Oh, that's just old Aunt Phoenix," she said. "She doesn't come for herself. She has a little grandson. She makes these trips just as regular as clockwork. She lives away back off the old Natchez Trace." She bent down. "Well, Aunt Phoenix, why don't you just take a seat? We won't keep you standing after your long trip," she pointed. The old woman sat down, bolt upright in the chair. "Now, how is the boy?" asked the nurse. Old Phoenix did not speak. "I said, how is the boy?" But Phoenix only waited and stared straight ahead, her face very solemn and withdrawn into rigidity. "Is his throat any better?" asked the nurse. "Aunt Phoenix, don't you hear me? Is your grandson's throat any better since the last time you came for the medicine?" With her hands on her knees, the old woman waited, silent, erect, and motionless, just as if she were in armor. "You mustn't take up our time this way, Aunt Phoenix," the nurse said. "Tell us quickly about your grandson and get it over. He isn't dead, is he?" At last there came a flicker and then a flame of comprehension across her face, and she spoke. "My grandson, it was my memory had left me. There I sat and forgot why I made my long trip." "Forgot?" the nurse frowned. "After you came so far?" Then Phoenix was like an old woman begging a dignified forgiveness for waking up frightened in the night. "I never did go to school. I was too old at the surrender," she said in a soft voice. "I'm an old woman without an education. It was my memory failing. My little grandson, he is just the same, and I forgot it in the coming." "Throat never heals, does it?" said the nurse, speaking in a loud, sure voice to old Phoenix. By now she had a card with something written on it, a little list. "Yes. Swallowed live. When was it? January? 2, 3 years ago? Phoenix spoke, unasked now. "No, Missy, he's not dead. He's just the same. Every little while, his throat began to close up again, and he not able to swallow. He not get his breath. He not able to help himself. So the time come around, and I go on another trip for the soothing medicine." "All right, the doctor said as long as you came to get it, you could have it," said the nurse. "But it's an obstinate case."
Okay, why don't we pause there. Thank you. What have we learned here? Finally, we learned the details about the reason for the trip, don't we? What are the circumstances?
It's the grandson.
It's a little grandson. And he was sick way back in the woods someplace. And he swallowed lye, and his throat is bad, and he needs medicine periodically. And they've agreed that anytime she comes to get it, they'll give it to her for free. And even though she seems to have lost track of why she's made the trip, her feet still get her there. Her feet still take her to the right floor in the big building and into the right door where the doctor's office is. And she goes on and says, "My little grandson, he sit up there in the house all wrapped up, waiting by himself," Phoenix went on. "We is the only two left in the world. He suffer, and it don't seem to put him back at all. He got a sweet look. He going to last. He wear a little patch quilt and peep out, holding his mouth open like a little bird. I remember so plain now. I not gonna forget him again, no, the whole enduring time. I could tell him from all the others in creation." All right. The nurse was trying to hush her now. She's talking too much. She brought her a bottle of medicine. Charity, she said, making a check mark in a book. And once again, we see the irony in this writer. Those in the office here consider they're doing charity for Phoenix, which in a sense they are, giving her the medicine for free. But the real charity, of course, is what Phoenix is doing for this child way back in the woods. Old Phoenix held the bottle close to her eyes and then carefully put it in her pocket. "I thank you," she said. "It's Christmas time, Grandma," said the attendant. "Could I give you a few pennies out of my purse?" "5 pennies is a nickel," said Phoenix stiffly. "Here's a nickel," said the attendant. Phoenix rose carefully and held out her hand. She received the nickel and then fished the other nickel out of her pocket and laid it beside the new one. She stared at her palm closely with her head on one side. Then she gave a little tap with her cane on the floor. "This is what come to me to do," she said. "I go into the store and buy my child a little windmill they sells made out of paper. He gonna find it hard to believe there is such a thing in the world. I'll march myself back where he waiting, holding it up straight in hand." And one of those little paper windmills. She lifted her free hand, gave a little nod, turned around and walked out of the doctor's office. Then her slow step began on the stairs, going down. Okay, there's the end of the story. Again, not much happens. But if we're paying close attention to everything that Eudora Welty has chosen to put into the story, what does it make us think of Phoenix Jackson? How do we respond to her?
We respond, in my opinion, how lucky we are. Okay, myself as a grandfather, I've been very fortunate, and I have three grandchildren. The only thing I ever prayed for when they were being born was that they would be born healthy. Nothing else.
Yeah.
It must be awful to live with something like that the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And I think that's what she had.
And apparently there are just two of them. There's no other family and no other neighbors who would be willing to make the trip for
her. Take that walk for her.
Pardon?
To take that walk for her.
Yeah, that's right. So she's doing it herself. And the title here is very important. It's a worn path. She has done this over and over and over again so that her feet know
where to go and where to stop.
Yeah, even though she can hardly see. She closes her eyes when she walks on the log over the creek. It's a real trial. She calls it a trial, but she makes it. She knows all the dangers that might come leaping out of the bushes at her, but she does it anyway.
Determined.
She's determined, yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. But you'd do it, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
If you were the only source of that medicine for your grandchild.
To keep him alive.
To keep him alive, you're doing a good job.
I see a person that suffers, person that can see, but doesn't exist, has life. When she sees the Sarah girl, she dances.
Yeah.
When she gets a nickel, she thinks of the windmill. She has, with all the pain and all the things going on, she is living life.
That's right. That's right. This is a life for all of us to admire, even though on the surface, you know, to the young hunter, she's just an old black woman wanting to go into town to see Santa Claus. Misses the point so badly, and that's what Eudora Welty wants us to see. That we are always doing this. We're stereotyping others. assuming perhaps little of them when they may be on some heroic mission as Phoenix Jackson is.
You know, it makes me think of just one experience with Habitat for Humanity. We had a house to give, and there was a 75-year-old grandma who had six grandchildren. She was there. And we had to decide whether to sell the house to her. And there were people who just, you know, really thought that was kind of foolish. How long is she going to be there, and how much good is she going to do? And finally, a Presbyterian pastor who was on the selection committee said, if we can make her life better for one day with what she's doing, it's worth doing. And as far as I know, it's been about 10 years and I think she's still on that house. But it just makes me kind of think of this woman, you know. You never, I mean, she could be 20 years old taking care of this child and die the next day unexpectedly. I think you...
Yeah, that's right.
And how many women are out there that are doing this, and how many people, you know, doesn't even enter their mind that what they can do to help, and it's, you know, to help somebody.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm struck at that this is only part of her story.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all these hints of incredible things in her life, like before the surrender, and I've had guns aimed. I've seen guns go off and people have done less than I've done.
Yeah.
You wonder, I mean, we know that the existence in the South and for a black person, there's a lot more to her story that makes her complex that we just can wonder about.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and the impoverishment, you get a sense of when she said, you know, he didn't even dream of knowing what a windmill might look like. You can sense that their world must be very empty.
Very, very simple, that's right. The 10-cent windmill is going to just make his day. Bob?
There are a couple other things I felt when I read the story. One was just the Natchez Trace itself. I don't know if anybody's ever driven it, but I drove a portion of it last fall with my daughter. And it's 444 miles of, it's now a national parkway that goes from Nashville down to the Mississippi River in Natchez, Tennessee. And even today, it's deserted. There's no... In 1941, I'm sure it was maybe even gravel, but it traces a wagon train path that cut through southwestern Tennessee down through northwestern Mississippi, and there's still no towns on the road. There's no gas stations. It's beautiful, but it's 50 miles an hour. They really patrol it. But if you're going to get to a town, if she went to a town, most of the towns are 5 or 6 miles off the trace. And so the only, so when she was walking down this road, there were probably poor blacks living along the road, and you know, people with dogs and stuff, like she described wild animals, really surprised me a bit. It's still pretty wild.
Yeah.
And that struck me. The other thing is just the condition of the grandson. He swallowed lye, and in medicine, that's a bad thing. This is why you keep your Drano off the floor when the little kids around.
Yeah.
Because this isn't going to get better.
Yeah.
But they burn their esophagus. You can't swallow. It probably burned the pharynx. The kid can't breathe.
Yeah.
And if this woman is real old, I don't know how old this child is, but the child may be fairly old by now. Parents probably just couldn't cope with it, I don't know. But, and the role of the medicine must have been pain relief. And this scars down, it doesn't get better. It used to be a way for people to commit suicide. It was a slow way to die. But it's not funny, and it doesn't get better. This kid's not going to get better.
Yeah.
That's the other tragedy of this.
Yeah.
She's old, and the child's not going to get better, and she's not going to be able to keep doing this.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
Do you ever have the feeling that the child may have died some time ago? She has such a problem with reality, and that maybe she feels a guilt, and she just can't stop this continual journey to get the medicine, even though it's for...
The nurse even asks that, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because she seems to have lost, you know, touch with reality. That's a perfect segue into the way I'd like to end the session. I thank you for doing that. Almost as inspiring to me as the story itself is what Eudora Welty has written about the story. She wrote a little essay about it. And usually we don't have access to a writer's explanation of the story. But Eudora Welty has written a couple pages in which she addresses that very question. And I thought that you would like to hear a few excerpts from this because it says so much, not only about this story and about that question, but about how writers go about doing their work and why they write. This is a little essay entitled, Is Phoenix Jackson's Grandson Really Dead? And here's what that Eudora Welty says. A story writer is more than happy to be read by students. The fact that these serious readers think and feel something in response to his work, he finds life-saving. I think she has wrote these remarks for a conference of student writers who are wanting to be fiction writers. And notice that she still uses the masculine language. She's talking about herself as a woman writer, but it's always he. This was before we began a major shift to inclusive language. At the same time, he may not always be able to reply to their specific questions in kind. I wondered if it might clarify something, both for the questioners and myself, if I set down a general reply to the question that comes to me most often in the mail from both students and their teachers after some classroom discussion. The unrivaled favorite is this. Is Phoenix Jackson's grandson really dead? It refers to a short story I wrote years ago called A Worn Pack, which tells of a day's journey an old woman makes on foot from deep in the country into town and into a doctor's office on behalf of her little grandson. He is at home, periodically ill, and periodically she comes for his medicine. They give it to her as usual. She receives it and starts the journey back. I mean, here again is a two-sentence summary of what happens in the story. She goes on to say that she wasn't writing this to try to mystify the reader. She goes on to say that it's really not fair to trick your readers and try to get them to believe that the grandson is alive and then all of a sudden at the end tell us that the grandson is dead. The writers don't try to do that. But after several paragraphs of saying this, she writes, the grandson's plight was real, and it made the truth of the story, which is the story of an errand of love carried out. If the child no longer lived, the truth would persist in the wornness of the path. But his being dead can't increase the truth of the story, can't affect it one way or another. I think I signal this because the end of the story has been reached before old Phoenix gets home again. She simply starts back. That's the end of the story. She's saying it's not important for us to know whether when she gets home there is a living child there or not. To the question, is the grandson really dead? I could reply that it doesn't make any difference. I could also say that I did not make him up in order to let him play a trick on Phoenix. But my best answer would be, Phoenix is alive. And that's the point of this story. It's not whether or not the grandson is there and she's lost it and she's just doing this out of forgotten habit, but it's her life. Phoenix is alive, and that's the important thing about this story. That's why she's a hero to me, is that despite things that would keep me from, that I think would keep me from making a trip of this danger and this difficulty, she does it. It's an act of love, and she does it over and over and over again. Welty goes on to say that the real dramatic force of a story depends on the strength of the emotion that has set it going. The emotional value is the measure of the reach of the story. This is similar to what Flannery O'Connor said about the real importance of the story is what happens spiritually, internally. What gives any such content to a worn path is not its circumstances, but its subject, the deep-grained habit of love. And that's what Phoenix Jackson participates in. What I hoped would come clear was that in the whole surround of this story, the world it threads through, the only certain thing at all is the worn path. The habit of love cuts through confusion and stumbles or contrives its way out of difficulty. It remembers the way even when it forgets, for a dumbfounded moment, its reason for being. The path of love, the habit of love is the thing that matters. And then she concludes, speaking to these student writers about their writing, by saying, like Phoenix, you work all your life to find your way through all the obstructions and the false appearances and the upsets you may have brought on yourself to reach a meaning, using inventions of your imagination, perhaps helped out by your dreams and bits of good luck. And finally, too, like Phoenix, you have to assume that what you are working in aid of is life, not death. We're working in aid of life, not death. But, she says, you would make the trip anyway, wouldn't you? Just on hope. I think that that essay is almost as powerful as the story. This is what life is about. We need to understand the habit of love, the emotional and spiritual journey that we're on. And that's what Phoenix's journey is all about, fraught with dangers and confusions and happy little moments of dancing and other moments of terror and seeing of ghosts and being patronized and being impoverished, but she's got her habit of love. She is on a mission of mercy. She will do it whether the little grandson is dead or alive. And the thing Welty wants us to see is that she makes this journey against all odds and almost instinctively, because she can hardly see. She can't read the name on a building or the number of the floor, but she gets to that place where that framed certificate is there, and she heads back. And it's a perfect place to end the story, because the trip back and whether the boy's alive or dead, she's saying, is not important. But what we've seen already is Phoenix's worn path and the path of her life, which is the habit of love. Well, it's time for us to quit, and we'll have supper soon. Any last comments?
Yeah, is there a point in each of our lives that we reach that point, that we, it's not about what happens to us, but other things that we thought about and just pushed back, and all of a sudden they're brought to our attention?
We aren't all that lucky to get to a point where we see it, you know, where we wake up. Someone said in a class the other day that character was sort of sleepwalking through life, and we need to be waked up. You know, it's one reason we go to church every day, because we hope that just hearing the gospel over and over and over again will speak to us. Maybe on one day when it didn't 3 years ago when we heard it last, or that we'll have a life experience that transforms us and makes us realize what's really important. If we're lucky that happens to us, we aren't all that lucky. But it's what we hope for, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what she says. You know, we take this trip of what we call life on hope that we'll figure it out, we'll do it right, we'll be of worth. You know, that's, we look for the grace of God for to have that happen for us. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.